Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, and all of it is brought to you by Casper Mattresses. Right now, you can get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/lunch and using promo code LUNCH at checkout. And Jim, once again, our good martini comes thanks to the misfortunes of the Democrats. This is from Politico. 1 year into Tom Perez's project to save the Democratic National Committee from complete collapse, officials are beginning to dig out of the hole left by Debbie Wasserman Schultz's mismanagement, Barack Obama's indifference, Russian hacking, and the bitter rivalry between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, capped by accusations of election rigging. But going into a midterm election that should be the Democrats to lose, the DNC is still struggling to bring its factions together and assert itself. Throw into the mix powerful super PACs, the much better funded party committees focused on Congress and governors, and more independent voters than ever, and many wonder if the DNC has a place at all anymore. Perez says, quote, "I knew it was a turnaround job when I ran, but I undeniably underestimated the depth of the turnaround job. We had to rebuild almost every facet of the organization, and equally importantly, we had to rebuild trust." And so there's still major fights going on. Perez and his deputy chairman, Keith Ellison, are often at loggerheads on issues and sometimes devolving into screaming matches. And right now the DNC is in a fun fight with Bernie Sanders because the DNC wants Sanders' massive voter list from 2016. Jim, I can't imagine why Bernie Sanders would be reluctant to hand that over to the DNC. So while most of the factors still work in the Democrats' favor, it would appear at this point anyway, heading into the midterm elections, it's good to know there's quite a bit of confusion and disarray at the top of the party.
Yeah, Greg, I just finished a piece for the magazine about Bernie Sanders' grassroots organization called Our Revolution, kind of documenting their trials and travails and you know, bumps along the road of 2017. The short answer is obviously that they have not had a smooth one. They endorsed about 110 candidates or so, and I think they had about 45 win. And a lot of them were like state legislative races, town council races, even local boards of education and things like that. So these were not terribly high-profile races. But one thing that came clear in the course of doing that article was just how much distrust and anger there still is among the Bernie bros, so to speak. And a lot of it is focused not just at Hillary Clinton, but at the Democratic National Committee. They do not trust Tom Perez. They very much want to completely overhaul the way that the presidential nomination process goes through for the Democrats. Basically, they want to get rid of superdelegates. And my suspicion is that you haven't heard a lot about this, but you'll hear more about this as primary season picks up in the spring of this year. I think, yes, obviously, there's a lot of Republican, going to be some tough primary fights. We talked about Joe Arpaio yesterday, but I think you're going to have a lot of tough Democratic fights. And there's going to be a good chunk of people that, whether they set out to be this way or not, are going to turn into proxy fights between the Clinton wing of the party and the Bernie Sanders wing of the party. And the Bernie Sanders wing of the party is not in a forgive and forget mood. And little things like saying, hey, you got to turn over your voter list. Look, the Sanders crowd is not going to be is not going to greet that kind of request kindly and warmly until they feel like they've got a much bigger seat at the table. And I think for obvious reasons, Tom Perez and the Clinton wing of the party don't want to give the Sanders wing that much of a seat at the table because they tend to be open socialists and sound like a bunch of nut jobs. So, look, no way of getting around it. Republicans have problems, but there's been a lot less attention paid to the fact that Democrats, they may unify in opposition to Trump, but they have much bigger differences about what actual policies should be enacted in to replace Trump's policies. And I suspect this is going to be a bigger issue in 2018 than people think.
Jim, I, for some reason, have the imagery of a coaching staff in the locker room with players right now. And the coaching staff is completely disorganized, completely in disarray. Their main job, though, is to fire up their players, and it looks like their players are already pretty fired up. So how big of a difference can this make?
Yeah, I was going to say the nice thing for Democrats is that they had an underwhelming candidate in Virginia and still managed to turn that into a big victory in the 2017 elections. Like I said, I think a big question is going to be how do these primaries shake out? And I guess one of the things that we very much on the right would be able to relate to is that right now the Bernie wing of the party doesn't trust the Hillary Clinton wing, believes that they're all corporate sellouts. In my article, I point out how people were livid that Jeff Weaver, the former head of the Sanders campaign, met with a billionaire. You know who that billionaire was, Greg?
Who?
Tom Steyer, the environmentalist who's running ads, you know, trashing Trump and all that kind of stuff. But by the very fact that he's a billionaire, that was seen as selling out and that he had sold out to corporate America and all that kind of stuff. So the Sanders crowd basically thinks anybody who's not with them is this terrible sellout and pawn of corporate America, et cetera, et cetera. So my guess is that you're going to see I don't know how easily those kinds of divides get healed after the primaries are done.
Let's move to some more immediate concerns in our bad martini. You lead off the Morning Jolt with this today by citing the Bangor Daily News of all outlets. Chances of a government shutdown grew Monday as Republicans concluded that they would be unable to reach a long-term spending accord by the Friday deadline. GOP leaders are now turning to a short-term funding measure in hopes of keeping agencies open while talks continue. But Democratic leaders say they are unlikely to support any deal that does not protect young illegal immigrants. Aides to key negotiators from both parties plan to meet Tuesday in an effort to rekindle budget talks, setting up a Wednesday meeting of the leaders themselves. If they cannot agree, the government would shut down at midnight Friday for the first time since 2013. So, Jim, as you point out, deja vu all over again. The different parties are in different positions than they were in 2013. And in other times when the government was threatened to shut down, in 2013, for example, Republicans controlled the House, Democrats had the Senate and the White House. Republicans got the blame. In 1995, Republicans controlled the House and the Senate. Democrats controlled the White House. Republicans got the blame. Now Republicans control it all. And even though it would be Democrats in the Senate that would basically be blocking a deal from getting done, Republicans will get the blame.
The Bangor Daily News is a fine, fine journalism institution, and not just because I used to write for them in my wire service days back in the early Bush administration. Look, I am one of those guys who contends that there's really no way Republicans can win a government shutdown fight. I realize, no, Jim, if we just articulate our arguments strongly enough, if we just stand forthrightly enough, the American people will stand with us and realize that it's all the Democrats' fault. No, I'm sorry, they won't. I wish they would. I think, you know, there are a lot of times Republicans have been unfairly blamed in the past. There have been a lot of times where Democrats have benefited from the fact that they knew that coverage was going to make the Republicans look stubborn and obstinate and unreasonable. And the Democrats just wanted to keep the government operating. And inevitably, media coverage will feature things like school buses full of kids who wanted to visit the Smithsonian and found the Smithsonian was closed. You can count on the Democratic administrations to shut down national parks. Remember, there was the silly velvet rope around the World War II memorial down to the National Mall. I don't see any way in which people don't, if the government shuts down while Republicans control the House, control the Senate, and control the presidency, I don't see a scenario where people come out of it feeling better about the Republicans. It may be that the Democrats are being stubborn on DACA. It may be that it's ridiculous that Democrats, nine Senate Democrats, won't vote with Republicans to keep the government open. But inevitably, a government shutdown will reflect badly on Republicans. People do not want the government to shut down. Whenever I say this, I hear people, Jim, you know, there are all those government workers who can stay home because they're deemed non-essential. Well, why don't we fire them all? We don't need any. Yes. You know, you can shut down the government for about 2 or 3 days before anybody really notices. If you're smart, you'd do it right before a long weekend. And then most of the federal workers would have off anyway. But after a while, the coverage begins to sink in. And Americans by and large don't want to think about government. They want government to just operate. They want to set it and forget it, which is one of those reasons where the more you have a government shutdown, the more people have to pay attention to Washington. And I think they just resent that in general. And they start to say, a pox on all your houses. Now, you're starting to see some Senate Democrats like Claire McCaskill say they don't that they're nervous about this. They don't think this would be wise. There are a couple of Senate Democrats who might be nervous about this. But I think a government shutdown just exacerbates frustration with Washington and creates an anti-incumbent mood. And Republicans in the majority party, even if, you know, a very slim majority in the Senate, that is bad news. You want people feeling good about incumbents as the midterm elections approach. So I don't see Republicans winning this. I think it's foolish that any Republican thinks they're going to come out of this smelling sweet as a rose. But we learn nothing from these government shutdowns. We just seem to be – it's like Wile E. Coyote. No, Greg, this time we're going to catch the Roadrunner. We're absolutely certain of it.
Well, and of course, the media deserves to be indicted here as well, because no matter what the scenario, as we've explained here, the Republicans always get the blame. But the question I think we're going to get, and others are going to get from conservatives, Jim, is – when do we ever win? We hold all the cards right now, but we don't have 60 votes in the Senate. So how do we get spending reductions going forward? Do we just have to accept the Democratic position on a no-strings-attached DACA enshrinement because they can hold up the works and we'll still get the blame? So do we ever win?
Well, one of the things that's worth noting here is that most, you know, the reason we have not had a government shutdown over the last couple of months is that they keep passing these short-term funding bills to keep the government open, to kind of keep everything set at the current level of funding. And there are a bunch of folks on the, you know, within the Republican Party who say, you know what, we were supposed to make some fairly significant investments in our defense spending. Each time we do these 2-week and 3-week and 1 month and little extensions, we're actually hurting ourselves. In short, there's not a unified Republican Party in support of deep spending cuts. The second thing is that there are a decent number of red state Democrats who you could pressure and probably could be, you know, quite effectively pressure, but you'd probably need to have a unified party all, you know, be marching in, be all singing from the same songbook. Which would mean it'd probably be very good if you had, say, the White House emphasizing this message, doing events in places like North Dakota and West Virginia, Missouri from McCaskill, things like that, maximizing the pressure on these Democratic senators instead of, say, still tweeting about a book that's, you know, came out 2 weeks ago again and again the entire weekend. So, but hey. You know, what do I know, Greg, right?
Oh, Jim, we still got a few days, so let's hope everybody gets a few good nights' rest and comes together with a reasonable way to protect the taxpayers while also keeping essential government operations functioning. And to do that, you might want to get a Casper mattress, because Casper is a sleep brand that makes expertly designed products to help you get your best rest one night at a time. The experts at Casper work tirelessly to make a quality sleep surface that cradles you in all the right places. After all, you spend one-third of your life sleeping, so you should probably be comfortable.
The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amount of both sink and bounce. It's a breathable design that helps you sleep cool and regulates your body temperature throughout the night. Casper now offers two other kinds of mattresses, the Wave and the Essential. The Wave features a patent-pending premium support system to mirror the natural shape of your body, while the Essential has a streamlined design at a price that won't keep you up at night. All Casper products are designed, developed, and assembled in the United States, and prices are affordable because Casper cuts out the middleman and sells directly to you.
Every Casper mattress is delivered right to your door in a small how-do-they-do-that-sized box. Plus, there's free shipping and hassle-free returns in the U.S. and Canada. Still not convinced? You can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. And right now, we've got a special offer to listeners of the 3 Martini Lunch. Get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/lunch and using the promo code LUNCH at checkout. That's casper.com/lunch and use the promo code LUNCH for $50 off select mattresses. Terms and conditions do apply. All right, Jim, let's talk about our crazy martini now. And of course, yesterday was Martin Luther King Day. And in addition to all of the wonderful tributes and all of the inspirational quotes that people shared out there, there's the increasingly annoying tradition of everyone co-opting Martin Luther King to back their pet political project at the present moment. John Blake over at CNN is perhaps the worst offender of this from Monday, listing three ways MLK speaks to our time. We're going to focus on two of these. Number one, he's an environmental hero. Even though he was killed before the environmental movement in its modern form got going, he still apparently directed us in the path of environmental justice by simply saying that there was an interconnected nature of life. And the best that Mr. Blake can do here is come up with a quote from a Christmas sermon that Dr. King gave, saying, "All life is interrelated. We are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. We are made to live together because of the interrelated structure of reality." The one that's getting the most eyebrows raised is number two. Quote, "He was a socialist before it was cool." Apparently socialism is cool, Jim. I don't know if the people in Venezuela would agree with that or in other places around the world that have been destroyed by socialism and attempts at communism. There's more evidence to support King actually believed a lot of the things we hear from the likes of Bernie Sanders. He called for universal health care and education, a guaranteed annual income, and the nationalization of some industries. He also seemed to support what we consider now a minimum wage. Obviously, he wasn't part of the 15 or fight movement. But first of all, the co-opting of Dr. King seems particularly odious at a time when we're obviously at political odds in pretty intense ways. And then the CNN notion that socialism is cool just takes it right over the edge.
Yeah, taking that in order, Greg. I mean, for starters, you'd think that what Martin Luther King stood for, fought for, and believed would be pretty clear. It's not like nobody's ever written a biography of this guy. It's not like there's no recordings of his speeches. It's not like there's a million and one articles and essays. It's not like he didn't write a letter from a Birmingham jail. Like if he had really wanted to beat the drum on the environment, I think he would have mentioned it a little more frequently. I don't think you'd have to look for a Christmas Day sermon that he mentioned one phrase in one passage of one sermon or something like that. Look, maybe if he were alive today, maybe he would be beating the drum for that. But I don't think you should really take him and his legacy and this important issue and try to shoehorn him into your pet project. And then this idea that socialism was cool. It is absolutely amazing how much socialism gets off the hook for all of the epic crimes of communism in a way that, you know, you could never imagine a parallel for Nazism or for any of the other unbelievably brutal regimes that have adopted particular philosophies around the world. It's also worth noting, I believe this writer at CNN was also the same one who said, you know, socialism isn't really an issue in Venezuela's problems. This is a comment of his on Twitter. Once you're willing to make that argument, it's very clear you are president of the socialism cheerleading fan club, and you do not actually, you know, want to acknowledge any contrary evidence. You are determined to let socialism off the hook forever. Well, I'm sure you basically would blame, you know, capitalism for every time anybody stubs their toe or something like that. So for CNN, this is a deeply unserious, it's not even like a thought-provoking hot tape or anything like that. It's kind of, I'd say, unworthy of the network, but I guess I shouldn't say that too loudly. God knows if they'll ever have me on again, Greg.
Well, this is the same network that I think the count was 195 profanities after the Trump story about his description of those countries came out. So
the only way to let people know that word, right, Greg? The only way you can't say bad word hole or bad word house. No, no, no. People would be left wondering, you know, if you say a four-letter word, people might think he said shoe or shot.
No, that's amazing. I think they were less offended than they led us to believe on that. I think they actually relished and reveled in being able to say that over and over and over again and having a premise to do it. So, Jim, another amazing day. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us. And don't forget to head to casper.com/lunch. Use promo code lunch at checkout and get $50 towards select mattresses from Casper. Join us again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.